This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello again, this is Marty Clancy, and I'm reading the book History of Belleville by Alvin Lewis Nebelsek. And when we stopped, we were on page 252, and they were just giving a description of Abraham Lincoln's speech, and they apparently didn't think much of it, so we'll pick it up from there. He predicated his whole speech upon the sale of a one-eyed horse for $27 that happened to be sold by a constable during the day. To what slight accidents are we frequently indebted for our great things? How very fortunate for the Whigs that Mr. Lincoln saw the sale of the one-eyed horse that day. He then enabled to prove that Mr. Van Buren caused it, together with all the other ills of life that us poor mortals are heir to. Late in the summer of 1839, Belleville was honored by a visit from the Vice President of the United States, the Honorable Richard M. Johnson, whom tradition credits with having shot Tecumseh and was the only Vice President to be elected by the United States Senate. He was making a tour of the states, feeling out the Democratic Convention in 1840. He was a guest of the Newhoff House, then a newly created large hotel. Here he held a meeting in the morning, which was attended by men in great numbers, regardless of party affiliation. In the evening, a brilliant ball was held, which was attended by the elite of the town and the surrounding country. Although Belleville has never been entirely flattered by its mention in the American Notes by Charles Dickens, it does feel a bit of pride in having had him as a guest as he and his party passed through here in April 1842 on their way to the Looking Glass Prairie near Lebanon. His stay here lasted but an hour or two while he took dinner. Court was in session at the time of his arrival, and the path nearly knee-deep in mud and slime which led to the forest that he sarcastically refers to was the public square. Of course, there was no pavings, and there may have been some mud and trees, and the buildings surrounding the square were early pioneer buildings of the time. Instead of the present courthouse, the old square brick one stood a little northeast of it, to which members of the bar hitched their horses, but they were not temporary hitching racks as Dickens described them. The old shambling low-roofed outhouse, half cowshed and half kitchen, in which he says he was entertained, was the mansion house, the best and largest brick house in the town. With the exception of the courthouse and the mill, it was anything but what he described it, actually being roomy and well-furnished, and having been recently erected at great cost by the Reverend Thomas Harrison, whose daughter and husband, Mr. and Mrs. William J. McBride, were its proprietors. The local paper reviewing his visit refuted his story that Belleville was a land of mud and brush, of frogs and pigs, and even inferred that he was decidedly drunk when he stated that the sun set on the opposite side of the Looking Glass Prairie, which, according to his story, would have been in the northeast. Abraham Lincoln paid his second visit to Belleville in the campaign of 1856 when he came at the invitation of William Bissell, who was running for the governorship of the state. He was a guest in the home of John Scheel on South Illinois Street, where the junior high school now stands. He met all the leading Republicans and in the evening spoke from a platform erected on the eastern end of the Market Square on the site of a filling station today. There was no heckling or disappointment by the audience at this rally, for Lincoln displayed the greatest ability, and it was admitted that his was the speech of the day. He captivated the Germans with his God Bless the Dutch, as he lauded them for their definite stand against slavery, saying they were more enthusiastic for the cause of freedom than any of the other nationalities. Although none of the Lincoln-Douglas debates were held in Belleville, Douglas was a guest here in 1858. He made a pompous entry accompanied by his beautiful wife, who had been the belle of Washington society. The town was crowded from the oration, for more than 500 people came from St. Louis to see and to hear him, but the local people on the whole showed little enthusiasm. In the late 60s, Mark Twain visited Belleville. He was writing a history of J.A. Slade, the Robin Hood of the Rocky Mountains, whose brother James P. Slade was a teacher in the Belleville schools and was able to supply the information sought by Mark Twain. On March 13, 1900, Eugene V. Debs, the socialist nominee for president, delivered a speech here on liberty. Noted places and events. The Dr. A. W. Wagner residence at 313 South High Street has been at one time or another the house of Lyman Trumbull, United States Senator from Illinois, and Theodore Kraft, first mayor of Belleville. The site of Hotel Belleville marks the location of one of Belleville's first log houses, which was constructed by a Mr. Carr in 1855. Later, a Mr. Knabel erected a fine brick hotel there, which in 1844 was raised to make way for the original Belleville House, which remained in use until 1930 when the present hotel was built. The Thomas House stood at the northwest corner of High and Main Streets, where it was built in 1854 when Belleville had a population of 8,000 at a cost of $20,000. Its proprietor specialized in vacation trade. It was a rather pretentious building, having rooms that were larger than those usually found in hotels, thereby affording better accommodations for those who spent their summer away from St. Louis. Other early rooming and boarding places were the California House, located on the west side of Charles Street and South Lincoln, the City Hotel on the southwest corner of West Main and South Third Streets, the Farmer's Home on the north side of Main Street between Church and Charles Street, the Franklin House on the south side of Main near Charles Street, the Illinois House on the south side of Main between High and Jackson Streets, and the Prudhoe Hotel located on the southeast corner of Illinois and Washington Streets. Besides these, there were the Railroad House, the Hinckley House, which is now the President Lincoln Hotel, the Greentree Hotel, the Hanover House, and the Napoleon House. Although classified as hotels, none of these, with the exception of the Belleville House, the Thomas House, and the Hinckley House, were actually that, but rather rooming and boarding houses. With few exceptions, they had their wagon yards where farmers would tie up their horses and teams while in town. Hotel Belleville today is Belleville's leading hotel with a total of 125 rooms. The Lincoln Hotel has 28. It is undeniably true that no city in Illinois has a more bewildering combination of the old and new in architecture than ours. Up-to-date bungalows and dwellings over 100 years old can be found side by side. The use of brick in the construction of the early homes was due to the fact that the city abounded in brick manufacturing plants instead of sawmills, making it not only the best but the cheapest construction material available. On January 17, 1844, a movement was started to buy some land for a county home for the poor. 40 acres northwest of Belleville were bought from Henry L. Million for $450. The first building erected here was constructed by George Eckert and Simon Eimer at a cost of $850 and was opened as a poorhouse on December 5, 1844. John Wright and his wife, its first superintendent and matron, received a salary of $150 per year. The city park and theater, after its construction in 1859, was for many years one of the city's leading places of amusement. It was located at the northwest corner of West A and North 2nd Streets, and at one time was the site of the Heberer Brewery. The City Park Garden, patterned after the European beer gardens, was for many years the gathering place of Belleville's old German families. It was a place of dignity and refinement, and had much of the flavor of old Vienna, expressing so typically all that is meant by the German word Gemütlichkeit. The theater was the scene of many gay balls where the youth of the day whirled in the waltzes and polkas, the self-same folks who today are the grandparents of our modern jitterbugs. In 1884, the theater was remodeled, having then a seating capacity of 1,000. Later, it became known as the Opera House. Shortly after 1900, it was destroyed by fire and had to be abandoned. Later, it was replaced by a light wooden structure called the Garden Theater. Anheuser-Busch Company of St. Louis had bought it in 1895, and at the time it catered to stock companies. After a few successful seasons, this too finally failed, and the place became the Budweiser Garden and was used only as a public dancing place. On the east half of this block stood the magnificent home of the distinguished citizen and statesman Adam W. Snyder. It was built in the 1830s and remained the homestead of three generations of his descendants when it was purchased by Dr. Edward M. Irwin, who later became a Republican congressman from this district. He in turn sold it to the federal government, which erected instead the present post office building. In 1910, George P. Stolberg established Belleville's first summer resort. He had bought the Deep Valley just west of his home, built a dam across the lower part of it, and had, as a result, a 15-acre lake that was as much as 6 feet deep in many places. And on June 2, 1902, Christian L. Ebsen, who was at that time the physical culture instructor for the Turner Society, purchased the lake known as Nipsol's Lake at the Star Brewing Park. It was one of the most popular resorts for swimming and outing for many years. Later, he disposed of it to the Turner Society, which made extensive improvements in making the pool a modern one and improving the grounds for picnic purposes. In February 1944, it was sold to Mr. E.J. Summers of the Summers Manufacturing Plant. West Haven Swimming Pool was built by Arthur Bush. It is located on the South Illinois Street, just outside of Belleville and next to West Haven Golf Course. St. Clair County's first county fair was inaugurated on October 18th and 19th, 1854, and from then on it was held yearly until the early part of the 1920s. A modern version of it was revived in 1939 and has been an annual event ever since. It was originally organized by the farmers and merchants who called themselves the St. Clair County Agricultural Society. The first fair was held on the Muscoota Park Road south of the Stone Bridge, 3/4 miles south of the courthouse. Later, a tract of land was bought south of Belleville in the Richland Creek Bottom area, east of the present South Illinois Street. This was given the name of the Belleville Fairgrounds. It was splendidly equipped with all the necessary exhibit buildings, an amphitheater, and a fine racetrack. Well-kept flower beds were laid out. This attractive spot was also the early place for an annual school picnic, an event which was unsurpassed by any other in Belleville. Fair days to the early citizens were gala ones. For many weeks, farmers and their wives prepared and planned on entries that would certainly bring them glory. The fair was among the best in the state, and 10 to 20,000 people attended every year. It was a meeting place for friends and relatives who rarely saw each other more than once a year. The fair proved so successful that it became necessary to run it an entire week. Thursday was the big day, and as many as 7,000 tickets were sold. People came as far as 40 miles by train and by horse-drawn vehicles. When the roads were good, the dust was 6 inches deep, and when it rained, the mud was twice as deep. One of the outstanding events held on Thursday was the ladies' driving and riding contest. In those days, women would not ride astride as they do now, but used a side saddle with but one stirrup. Their riding habit consisted of a short jacket, a long draped skirt, and light hat, giving them a picturesque appearance. An annual event of recent years is the homecoming, sponsored each fall by the Junior Chamber of Commerce. At times, it has been held in the athletic field, located at South Illinois Street and Cleveland Avenue. For the last few years, it was held in the parking lot between North Illinois and High Streets. One of the most successful of these was supervised by Waldo Tisch, who was the general manager of the committee in 1940. In pioneer days, people took their politics seriously, and Belleville was no exception, for its citizens entered into all the campaigns with great enthusiasm. Many spectacular parades were held. Streets were decorated with flags and business places were illuminated, adding color to the occasion. The Republicans and Democrats vied with one another in their ambition to put on the biggest show. One such noted event was the huge demonstration staged by the Republican Party on Saturday evening, October 18, 1856. The number taking part in the torchlight parade, including those at the speaker's stand, was estimated at 6,000. And Lebanon was represented with 300, Muscoota with 300, among other citizens that sent their delegations, each carrying a banner emblazoned with different slogans. One of them read, "We earn the bread we eat, and we eat the bread we earn." There were 800 torches carried in the parade, 30 ornamental lanterns on poles, several bands furnished the music, and many banners were waved. Seated on the platform with Abraham Lincoln were Lyman Trumbull, William H. Bissell, candidate for governor, and Gustav Kerner, speaker on the occasion. On May 23, 1879, Women's Christian Temperance Union was organized here by Frances Willard, its national leader. 20 members attended the first meeting and all signed the charter. It was disbanded in 1881, reorganized on March 16, 1882, and still retains a small membership here. Whereas fatal accidents today receive only passing interest, such was not the case in that of Belleville's first traffic tragedy on June 5, 1911. It occurred when Carl Frost was instantly killed and S.F. McKinney, a 60-year-old contractor, was seriously injured. McKinney's car was traveling west on Main Street near the Belt Railroad when the machine was struck by a fast westbound suburban streetcar. On March 10, 1914, the 100th anniversary of the selection of Belleville as the county seat was duly celebrated. The program began at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with an invocation by the Right Reverend Henry Althoff, after which Governor Edward F. Dunn delivered an address calling attention to the great men who had lived in this county. Following this, a celebration was held at the Elks Club, at which a bronze tablet, which had been placed in the northeast corner of the building, marking the spot where the first building in Belleville had been erected, was unveiled. Belleville's population growth had been a uniform one. According to the United States Census statistics, it has been as follows. 1850, 2,941. 1860, 7,239. 1870, 8,146. 1880, 10,683, 1890, 13,361, 1900, 17,484, 1910, 21,132, 1920, 24,835, 1930, 28,425, 1940, 28,405, and 1950, 32,700. Of its present population, 93.5% of its people are of native white birth, 6% are foreign-born, and 0.5% are Negro. It has 7,630 families living in 6,833 dwellings, of which 4,576 or 67% privately owned. Its population is a cross-section of many nationalities, but those of German descent greatly outnumber all others. Democratic institutions, besides giving us political and religious freedom, afford every man an equal chance to get along in the world. They have welded us together as an incredibly short time, which still allowing the individual his national differences and non-essentials. Nothing impresses the foreigner visiting our country more than do our fine schools and universities and the rapidity with which immigrants emerge from the melting pot as real Americans. Belleville now represents the result of 145 years of growth. It has never been a boom town. It has reached its population and size through a steady, unaltering advance, which has given it stability. As far as numerical strength of family names is concerned, the Mueller family leads them all. The 1941 edition of Polk City Directory lists 102 persons by that name. The next in order were 100 Millers, 97 Schmidts, 65 Smiths, 59 Johnsons, 37 Browns, 33 Joneses, and 32 Brauns. Belleville's altitude is from 420 to 630 feet above sea level, while that of East St. Louis is but 415 feet. The average temperature is 56.3 degrees Fahrenheit. The seasonal range is 48.4 degrees from a January mean of 31.9 to a July mean of 89.3 degrees. Thus, 5 months are cool, 3 are warm, and 4 are hot. The growing season extends from April 4th to October 27th, amounting to about 190 days. The mean annual rainfall is 39.7 inches, while the average humidity is 70. The mean annual sunshine is 62%, although 4 months have more than 70%. Prevailing winds are from the south. This is an average established by the measurements taken from the government over a period of 85 years from 1837 to 1922. Chapter 13, Looking Ahead, What Makes a Good City? A community is a group of people living together in a given locality and bound together by a common interest and common law. A community as a whole will make an effort to be a model one so that it will be attractive to others and its citizens will desire to live in no other place. Every community has features which prove to be an asset or a liability. If it is located on a river, it has a natural means of transportation, and thriving trade is likely to develop. Lacking that, it behooves it to provide some other means of transportation, such as highways and railroads, to and from some large commercial center. This always pays great dividends. The first step toward making a good city is to study the causes which have made the best cities as good as they are. Every city has its individual peculiarities. No two are identical. The more familiar one is with different cities, the greater a variation is revealed. Clothes, gear, entertainment, and interest may seem similar, but a deeper study of them reveals that these similarities are only skin deep. Some cities are very negligent in their provisions for health, comfort, education, recreation, and other features of good living and well-being. This is partly due to a lack of resources and partly to the inactivity of its citizens to realize what a city can and should be. Its inhabitants fail to compare their city with more progressive ones and are unaware of what others have accomplished. On the other hand, there are critics which have nearly attained economic perfection through many of their residents are ignorant of their good fortune. And one of the first lessons that citizens should learn is that it is not only the prevention and the cure of disease, but the preservation of health that is the goal of modern health agencies. To preserve health, they must learn to cooperate with all the agencies teaching modern hygiene and sanitation. Some facts relative to the average American city are summed up as follows. 60% of all 16 and 17-year-old boys and girls are in school. 23% of all homes use gas. 24% use electricity. 12% have telephones and radios. And the infant death rate for 1 year is below 63 per thousand. Cities differ greatly in qualities which are virtually important for human living. The chances that a baby will die within a year after its birth are greater in some cities than in others. This is partly due to ignorant and careless parents. It is also due to standards of living which are high or low according to the community's management of its health and sanitation problems. In some cities, the infant death rate is 5 times as great as in others. In some, the deaths per thousand population from typhoid are over 20 times as great as others. Standards for health are measured by the general death rate. The better cities are those in which the people have a better chance of living. In 1929, the total national bill for medical care amounted to $3,656,000,000, or about 4% of the national income, a per capita expense of $30 for every man, woman, and child in the country. The government contends that there should be 142 doctors per 100,000 population, which should give us 45. There should be 179 dentists to every 100,000 population, which according to Belleville's population would amount to 55. Education standards are measured by the per capita public expenditures for public schools as a whole, for teachers and their salaries, for textbook supplies, for libraries. It is measured also by the percentage of people, 16 to 20-year-olds, attending school. A city ranks high educationally when its citizens are given more dollars worth of educational opportunity and when its youth can remain in school longer. To rank high in recreation, a city must consider two things. One, per capita public expense for recreation, and two, the per capita cost of acreage. Where human problems, the housing program, wages and working conditions, educational and health facilities are constantly watched and corrected to meet new and progressive social and economic conditions, a better city will result. Human needs are the first requisite of any well-governed city. Some cities, hoping to improve themselves, have gone into various forms of business enterprises, operating transit systems, electric utilities, gas plants, and even housing projects. In 1938, 4/5 of all cities of more than 5,000 population owned some form of public utility. 72% owned their own waterworks, 15.8% owned their own light plants, 40.7% had sewage disposal plants, and 22.5% owned and operated a city airport. Contributing factors towards community welfare are reflected in the lowered rates of mortality from social diseases, homicide, and automobile accidents. It is reflected also in the value of a city's property, its schools, libraries, parks, and recreational facilities. It is good to live where there are only a minimum of violent deaths, where through wisdom and honesty of good administration, liberal provisions have been made for educational, recreational, and health programs without burdening taxpayers with a heavy debt. As a rule, suburban residential cities are considered preferable, for here our homes are located away from the noise and grime of traffic, factories, or railroads. They usually have comfortable homes large enough to provide comfort for every member of the family. And they are equipped with modern plumbing, electric lights, gas or electric stoves, central heating systems, and all the other conveniences of labor-saving devices. When in congested districts, homes lack the bare essentials for decent living, tenements and slums result. Here, 10 to 15 people live in two or three small, unsanitary, dark, dingy rooms. In some cities, one-fifth or more of the total population lives in miserable hovels, totally unfit for human habitation. The question then arises, why do so many Americans live in poor houses? The answer is that their income is too low. A city's general welfare depends just as much on wealth and income as it does on personal, moral, and mental qualities. In determining the mental or moral qualities, the following must be considered: number of persons per thousand graduating from public schools per year, the percent of taxes devoted for maintenance of public libraries, the percent of literacy in the total population, the percent of literacy among those between the ages of 15 and 24, the per capita circulation of public library books, the per capita number of homes owned, the per capita number of telephones, the number of dentists divided by the number of lawyers, the excess of the number of physicians, trained nurses and teachers over the number of male domestic servants, a low per capita number of deaths from social disease, and a low per capita number of deaths from homicides. Measured by this standard, cities differ very vastly. It is indeed a high-ranking community whose citizens live decently, who demand the best in education, who read good books, who spend their personal money to buy a home, who are more concerned about their children's teeth than they are in engaging in a lawsuit. They insist that public money be wisely spent for teachers, schools, libraries, and parks, and they abhor meddling politicians, jails, and lack of law enforcement. Some of the present trends which are impairing residential areas and cities and which constitute so important part of economic structure are the withdrawal of the population to suburban areas, the emergence of large blight districts, the depreciation of property values, the impairment of tax structures, and the increased costs for police, fire, and welfare services in the worst rundown areas. There is also such a vast difference in living costs in various localities. This, too, is important to the breadwinner, who quite naturally chooses to live where his money buys most. In cities where both wages and salaries are below the average, people fool themselves into believing that their cost of living is lower, when in reality this is not the case. The real fact is that their scale of living is low, and that citizens live in less comfortable homes. They eat cheaper qualities of foods, wear cheaper clothes, enjoy cheaper entertainment, and have inferior schools. It is not and cannot be the same life at a lower cost. One gets what one pays for. It is essential that a city maintains a good reputation. Too often, it is belittled by would-be writers who think it is smart to write derogatory articles, exaggerating its weaker points instead of extolling its many good ones. Too many people know Pittsburgh only as the place where hunkies make steel. Joliet, Illinois, too, is often associated only with convicts. Chicago always conjures up gangsters, while Belleville is too often spoken of deridingly as a little German village. Let us remember that the good name of a city is as priceless as the reputation of an individual. It is up to the citizens themselves to maintain the good name of their city by constantly boosting it. Everybody likes the man who is proud of his community and the one whose community is proud of him. To attract outsiders, many cities have adopted city planning. Often, financial difficulties of municipalities may be traced to their failure to adopt effective measures for the present and future. City planning holds city expenditures and the direction of its development and growth within the bounds of economical and wise administration. Effective city planning depends on an understanding of what planning can and should do to protect the standards of living. Effective planning will also stabilize property values. To arouse an interest and to maintain it, the slogan "It pays to plan" should be adopted universally. No growing community can afford to be without a planning program, lest it encourage waste and disorder. A planning program charts the way to order, convenience, safety, comfort, and beauty. In 1922, there were only 185 cities and towns that practiced city planning. Today, there are more than 1,700, and there would be many more were it not for the lack of understanding on the part of the citizens. Present-day city planners relegate residential areas to quiet, clean neighborhoods. They lay out a city, its streets, parks, recreation centers, business, industrial, and residential sections with the idea of providing the utmost in health, beauty, and convenience for the entire community. How to improve this city. Recognizing the factors that contribute toward making a city good or bad, we have yet to mention that which makes a city better. Today, both industry and business use scientific measurements as an index to their financial condition and well-being. No longer do they merely take a casual look to see how things are progressing. Instead, they have explicit measurements which indicate clearly and concisely what each department is accomplishing. Cities can do the same. It is important to know what is being done for health, education, character, comfort, security, and entertainment. When a tornado sweeps through a community, one immediately reads about it in the newspapers, where it is given much publicity. On the contrary, when an epidemic breaks out, newspapers scarcely mention it, or if they do, it is put on an obscure page. When new homes are built, one sees them, but if the circulation of the public library or the number of property owners increases, few citizens are aware of it. The following 10-item yardstick, which anybody can apply, will tell fairly accurately how a city measures up in general welfare. Item 1. Get from the health officer the number of deaths per year of infants ranging from 1 to 365 days per 1,000 live births. Subtract this number from 120 and multiply the result by 2. Cities vary from 20 to 164 points. Item 2. Get from the city treasurer this year's expenditures for the operation and maintenance of the Department of Recreation. Divide this amount by the estimated population of the city and take 10 times the quotient expressed in dollars. Cities vary from 5 to 40 points. Item 3. Get from the city treasurer the estimated value of all the city's properties in the forms of schools, libraries, museums, parks, and other recreational facilities. Divide the amount by the estimated population of the city. Then multiply the result expressed in dollars by 1.25. Cities vary from 72 to 161 points. Item 4. Get from the city treasurer the total value of all public property used for municipal and public services, exclusive of streets and sewers. Get also the net public debt, subtract the latter from the former, and divide by the population. Enter a credit of 1 for every $3 per capita excess of property over debt. In case the city owes more than its public property is worth, enter the appropriate negative number. Cities vary from 10 to 46 points. Item 5. Get from the city treasurer or from the superintendent of schools the expenditures for the operation and maintenance of schools. Do not include the capital outlays or payment of interest of school debt. Divide the amount by the population, multiply number of dollars in the quotient by 2. That is, enter a credit of 1 for every 50 cents per capita spent. Cities vary from 23 to 56 points. Item 6. Get from the person in charge of the public library the circulation of books as he would report it to the American Library Association. Divide this number by the city's population. Multiply the results by 5. Cities vary from 11 to 84 points. Item 7. Get from the superintendent of schools the number of persons who graduated from senior high school during the year and divide this number by the city's population. Multiply the quotient by 14141. Cities vary from 69 to 191 points. Item 8. Get from the superintendent of schools the number of pupils in school who were aged 16 years and no months to 17 years and 11 months living in the city at that date and give credit of 1 for each 1%. Cities vary from 52 to 92 points. Item 9. Get from the superintendent of the telephone company the number of subscribers. Multiply the number of phones by 333 and divide the product by the city's population. That is, give a credit of 1 for every 3 phones per 1,000 population. Cities vary from 25 to 90 points. Item 10. Get from the power company the number of homes that are supplied with electricity. Multiply by 200 and divide by the city's population. That is, give credit of 2 for each domestic installation of electricity per 100 population. Cities vary from 30 to 64 points. Add the results of the 10 entries, the total should be between 300 to 1,000. The average city totals 575. To improve a city, therefore, one must begin with the home, with the neighborhood, and with the individual family. Trees should be planted along vacant lots, which should be cleaned. Support the neighborhood grocer or he will leave. One must live within one's income, at the same time providing well for one's family. Nothing justifies a loafer, deadbeat, or family deserter. To raise a city's status, we must avoid the things that tend to lower the standard of living. To raise the standard, it behooves us to remove our slums because they are wasteful and dangerous, and it is cruel to tolerate them. Suburbs should cooperate with big cities in providing recreational facilities, even though they have private yards, gardens, and country clubs. Better still, they should merge with neighboring communities because their territory is contiguous. Therefore, by sharing in the public benefits, which now they are denied, such as sewer and garbage disposal systems, public parks, and reduced insurance rates with added fire protection. A good citizen is as loyal to his city as he is to his family, his church, and his clubs. Even the poorest city protects his person, property, and educates his children. Few citizens give as much as they receive. Too many take the streets, sewers, water, light, schools, and parks for granted, like so much sunshine and rain. We belong to our city, and it in turn belongs to us. A city needs to see itself as it really is, so as to see itself better in the future. Its citizens need to sell it to others, and to do so they must believe it is a good one. Always point out in good features instead of emphasizing its shortcomings. Remembering always that to sell a community to others, its dwellers must be sold on it themselves. Schools may profitably consider extending the distribution of educations so that it will reach all those who crave and deserve it. Churches may profitably consider further development of activities in which they are already engaged. They can increase their support of welfare work. They should maintain a well-balanced budget to provide for the upkeep of the church buildings, the minister, good music, overhead expenses, and charity. There should be a consolidation of churches. The increased promotion of spiritual life should be their prime concern. If a church fulfills this duty, it cannot help but improve the community. Political parties should agree to support and keep out of politics the impartial recommendations of experts in public health, education, recreation, prevention of crime, prevention of poverty, and general welfare. Businessmen and manufacturers can do much to improve a city. If they pay low wages, it will handicap the schools, churches, and clubs. Businessmen should be honest and should protect their customers from paying for lies, flattery, false hopes, and deceptive advertising. In order that a city may remain at a high level, citizens must constantly keep before them the following. 1. How many babies born in the community died during the first year? 2. How many of the boys and girls 16 or 17 years attend school? 3. How many of its people own their own homes? 4. How fully are the homes provided with electricity? 5. How many have telephone service? 6. How general is illiteracy? 7. How much crime is there? 8. How many of the homes are worth less than $1,500 or rent for less than $15 a month? 9. How much is spent for teacher salaries per capita? 10. How well are the residents protected against communicable diseases? Every good citizen must always resolve to do everything within his power to improve his community in each of the above mentioned. He must also help in seeing to its cleanliness, beauty, health, order, leisure, and security. It is our solemn duty to transmit the city to the coming generations more beautiful than it was transmitted to us. Let us remember that all the good the past has had remains to make our own time glad. When we build, therefore, let us think we are building forever. Let it not be for the present delight, nor for present use alone. Let it be such work as our descendants will be grateful for. Let us think as we lay our stone on stone that a time is to come when these stones will be held sacred because our hands have touched them, and that men will say as they look upon the labor and the wrought substances of them, "This our fathers did for us." And so this is the end of the reading of the book, A History of Belleville by Alvin Lewis Nebelsick. It's been my pleasure to read this to you, and I do apologize again. My German is not always that good. I'll be back later with another book. So until then, everyone have a good day, and I'll see you later.